Welcome, this is Ken McCarthy with Jazz on the Tube, and today we're going to be interviewing someone who's got a great jazz website. His name is Tom Cunniff, and his website is jazzhistoryonline.com, and we're going to learn about how it got started, how it runs, and some of the great stuff that's on it. I've already found a lot of interesting stuff. In fact, the way I found the website was I was looking something up, and there was a really useful and helpful article on the topic that I was interested in, and I thought, wow, let me look into this a little deeper. And the deeper I went, the more I liked it. And so I thought, hey, I'm going to call Tom up and introduce myself and introduce him to our Jazz on the Tube community. So welcome, Tom.
Thank you. Thank you. So tell me, what was the article that you were looking at?
Okay. You know that, and I don't know her. I can't remember her name, but there's a French singer who, I guess failed her.
Camille Berthaud?
Yeah. And then she made a, she wrote some words to Giant Steps.
Uh-huh.
And scatted the John Coltrane improvisation.
Yeah.
And I loved that. And I thought, who is this person? You know, and I looked her up and I came right to your article.
Oh yeah, that's great. Yeah, she's wonderful. She was a lot of fun to work with, to do the interview and so forth. I saw her online, and I think I saw Mr. PC before I saw Giant Steps, but
okay.
I was just like, my God, nobody can scat John Coltrane, but she can. And I said, I got to find out who this woman is. And so I did some searching around, and her career is just going out of sight right now. She's a Sony artist now. And she did her first album on Sunnyside, which was done actually before she started doing all these videos. And yeah, I just actually caught something of her this morning. I was looking it out on Facebook.
Oh,
so.
What I read was a text piece. So you actually interviewed her as well.
Oh yes, I interviewed her, and we included several of her videos in the piece.
Oh,
you have
great.
To look at it on the piece on a PC or a desktop computer in order to see to see it. But we do a lot of that embedding video and so forth into the pieces.
Oh yes, it's really a wonder that we can do that. It's so great.
Yeah,
because you talk about music, which is fine. And you talk with the artist, which is good, but then if you can show the work on the same page, it just doesn't get any better.
Absolutely.
So tell me, Tom, how did Jazz History Online get started?
Well, I had been working for jazz.com for a couple of years under Ted Gioia, and I had started as a writer with him. Bill Kirchner hit me to the site, and I had known Ted Gioia's work for many, many years and really respected him, and I sent him a couple things, and lo and behold, they showed up as track reviews, like instantly. I started writing regular pieces for them, handled the DVDs reviews for them, and after about 5 or 6 months, Ted said, called me up and said, "Look, we're changing our editors," and he says, "We're going to put, instead of having one person doing all the editing, we're going to split it up over about 5 people." He says, "But you're my top guy." And I said, "How did I earn that?" And he says, "Everything you've sent to me, I've never had to change one comma. Everything is perfect when you send it to me." He says, that's "I'll show you how to do the editing for other people, but here's how here's what we do." And so I started being an editor, and I worked for them until they ran out of money. And unfortunately, jazz.com is no longer online. They kept it around for quite a while, but I didn't have any place to write. So this was in 2009, the end of 2009, and I worked a little bit freelance here and there, but I wasn't really writing very much. And I was in a choir that I had been in for like 10 years, named Cantori from here in Denver, and we were a virtuoso choir, a cappella group, and we were in Chicago to sing for the American Choral Directors Association National Convention. And right after doing a rehearsal in Orchestra Hall, I had a previously planned lunch with 4 of the women from the group. We were just kind of all hanging out while we were in Chicago. So we sat down at lunch, and almost instantly the question came down, "What do you mean you're not writing about jazz anywhere, Tom?" And it's like, "Well, I just don't have really a place." you need a website. And that was in February of 2011.
Okay.
And July 19th, 2011, we launched Jazz History Online. And I've talked to all those women since then, of course, and they're like, we thought you were going to do a blog, Tom. We had no idea you were going to make an online magazine. And I said, well, there was a lot of stuff I wanted to write about it, and and I'd been thinking about how I wanted to do this. And so we, you know, I've done it, and it's a lot of work every month. I have over 500 pages on this site. So I've been putting stuff up on a monthly basis for the last 6 years now. Mm-hmm. And it is something that I consider it my legacy. I consider it to be how I will be remembered. And I'm very proud of the things that we've put up there. We've had a lot of really amazing, a lot of good response to things that you wouldn't find in Downbeat. You won't find like what we have right now on the website. I have the first part of two on Frankie Newton, great trumpet player from the 30s. And I've written 6,500 words of it. And virtually everything is linked to YouTube or to purchase links, so you can hear the music of Frankie Newton. He's virtually forgotten now, but he was a big trumpet player in the 30s, was on the Strange Fruit session of Billie Holiday, on Bessie Smith's last session, Maxine Sullivan's Loch Lomond. He was the first trumpeter for the John Kirby sextet. But he is not so well known now. He's basically been forgotten. He had a lot of gaps in his recording career, and I've been trying to go through and try to figure out, well, why was that the case? And the answers are not what most people are saying. So hopefully I'm hitting something different and hoping people will look at my opinion and say, hey, this makes more sense than what other people say. We'll hope. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And you know, the web has many virtues, but two of them are you can start where you are and just add to it. And next thing you know, you've got 500 pages up.
That's right. That's right.
And, you know, in a book, you know, you have to finish the whole thing, and and sometimes books don't get finished, or they don't get published, or they get published and no one sees them. But
right.
With something like this, you just add one brick a day,
uh-huh.
And next thing you know, you have the Great Wall of China.
Yes, indeed.
I actually learned that from a drummer. He came from a bricklaying family in the north of England, and he had been a bricklayer as a kid, and then he became a punk rock drummer.
Wow.
And he was telling me about his experiences on the Great Wall of China, and he said he was just stunned. And then he had this revelation, well, they just built it one brick on top of another.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So that's what you're doing. And then the other thing that's so great about the web is we don't have the kind of commercial pressures that, let's say, a print magazine would have. They've got, you know, they got to print, they've got to put things in the mail, they've got to pay, you know,
right.
photographers, all kinds of stuff. So we can pay attention to artists, worthy artists, who
right.
don't have a, quote, commercial value, you know.
Yeah.
Or, you know what I mean? They're great artists, they're great musicians, but there's nobody with a budget to push them.
Right,
And so, like, you know, for example, you know, the guy that you're writing about, Frankie Newton.
Yeah.
These people are important, and
right.
we're all enriched by knowing them.
Right. And, you know, somebody had told me when I was in, you know, 20 years ago or 25 years ago, you're going to end up writing a magazine, Tom. You're going to end up doing it. I'm going to say, you're out of your mind. You know, because I knew what the printing costs and all that went into it. I had studied some of that in school. And all the stuff you got to do to make sure your four colors are all straight and all that stuff, and getting it in the mail and dealing with the stores and everything else. And this is beautiful. And not only do you not have the long wait time,
right.
you know that's beauty, because I can go in and I can write something, publish it, boom, there it is. You can read it.
Yep.
You know, that's wonderful. And that means that I can review albums, and I beat Downbeat by 6 weeks. You know, I can publish my review, and then I wait around and see what Downbeat thought, you know. So
Yeah. And if you want to stretch out and you know, with someone like Frankie Newton,
yeah.
and just go into it you're not limited. You're not having an editor say, well, make it fit on a page or make it fit in two columns.
Well, I have myself telling me that, but yes, I try to keep them from getting huge. But there's times when the subject justifies it. You know, I mean, when Mosaic put out the Louis Armstrong set, the live thing that Ricky Riccardi and Scott Wenzel put out, all the live recordings of the All Stars, and it's 11 CDs, and a lot of music that people had not heard because it had been cut up and put out under false, you know, stories and so forth, things that were made in the studio were marketed as live and vice versa and so on. And I felt that it was really necessary to go basically session by session, track by track, and talk about where the differences are so that people knew what they were getting. It bothers me when I get, you know, I get the same 11 CD set for free from the record company that somebody at a major newspaper gets, right, or a magazine. And you read their review, and it's like, did you listen past the second disc of the set? You know, I mean, I listened when I work on these things, I go through them all completely. I might cut it down, put down my thoughts in 1700 words or whatever it is, but I always, you know, I make sure that I do justice. You know, you sent me this thing, I'm going to listen to it. I'm going to listen and appreciate what you've done. And that's the same with a new CD, and that's the same with a reissue CD, anything that have out a book or whatever. Let's make sure that it's handled with respect to the artist and the respect to the people to put it together.
That's great. And we're talking about jazzhistoryonline.com.
Thank you.
As I look at the tabs you've got, you have CD reviews, of course,
yeah.
DVD reviews, concert reviews, and then a section I really like, in addition to book reviews, is your retro reviews.
Thank you. I love that.
Talk about that a little bit, the retro review section.
Well, we're a history site. I came to this conclusion way early, at the very beginning, actually before we published the first issue. We're a history site. We review old records as well as new records.
Mm-hmm.
The general rule about the retro review, it's either a new reissue or it can be anything that's over 20 years old.
Okay.
So the idea is to be able to go back and listen again to something and see how it feels now compared to when you first heard it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Out to Lunch is Eric Dolphy. Out to Lunch is a great example of why this is a great thing to do. When I first listened to it, it made no sense to me, and I liked Dolphy, but I had a real hard time with that record. And I went through several copies of it trying to figure it out, you know, and, you know, listened to it and gave up on it and sold the record and then go buy another copy of it and listen to it again. But it took going through and doing a little bit more research on it and about the time that it was made and things like that before I really understood what it was all about. And that's why that retro review is there, you know. And I really, you know, we've really, I found some things that are really amazing records that people don't know about. There's a Count Basie record, Count Basie and Joe Williams, called Memories Ad Lib on Roulette. I don't believe it's ever showed up on CD. If it did, I would have one.
Oh.
This record is rare. You want to know how rare? There's
how
five
rare?
Freddie Green solos on this record.
Really?
Yeah. He five actual, you know, 8-bar things on acoustic. It's, you know, you have to turn the thing up, and it's a record, so you got to get it up and listen to the scratches and stuff. But Freddie Green agreed on this little small group date to record, and it's the greatest concentration of Freddie Green solos in any one place on his whole career.
And this is a record that's never made it to CD?
Never made it to CD. As a matter of fact, I talked to... They don't do the singles anymore at Mosaic because they didn't make any money on it, I guess, or it was not a cost worthy or whatever. But one of the things that I thought, and essentially it's in the piece, that this would be a perfect one to do because they can get into the Roulette, you know, vaults. That's all part of EMI, and there's a couple tunes that were never released out of that session. And it's like, oh, we should put this thing out. This thing's a treasure. And one of these days it'll show up. Somebody will put it out. And it's just one of those records, and you just go, how did I miss this? You know, and I'm glad I found it, you know.
there's so much material like that.
Oh yeah.
It's a bottomless well. And I see you have the famous you have a review of the famous Red Beans and Risley yours, Satchmo at the National Press Club concert.
Yes, that was one of the really it was a new reissue at the time that Smithsonian Folkways had put out, and I wrote something up about that. That's an interesting little record. It's of course one of Louis's last performances, and so it's a really it's a fascinating document to have. It's you know, not as doesn't have as many great moments as obviously as that Mosaic set does, but it is a very valuable document, and I'm very glad Smithsonian put it out.
And speaking of Mosaic, one of my favorite musicians is Lester Young. You did a review of the Count Basie and Lester Young live and in the studio.
Yes.
Now, you say that the artistry of these musicians can be understood in greater detail than ever before. Why is this set so important for understanding Lester and Count Basie?
Well, you've got some unissued takes in there. You've got some things that haven't. You get all the music in one place. You know, you're looking on that Lester set, we're talking about stuff that's been issued by different companies and on different labels, and it wasn't all owned by Verve at one time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so you end up jumping around, and you might not hear, you hear it with, when you hear it in the, especially the later Lester things, you're listening to them in context of the time frame. And I listened to it, even though it splits up. I believe it split up a little bit on the disc because of the record companies and who made the disc and so forth, you know. But if you listen to the recordings in strict chronological order, you understand that no, Lester was not completely destroyed by the army thing. He was already changing his style before he went in the service. And so, you know, and he used to say, I don't want to be a repeater pencil. That was what he meant. He wanted to be original. He wanted to keep his style fresh. And he didn't want to sound like he did in the 30s because he was a different person. So when you listen to the recordings and you get the Dickie Wells session for Signature in there alongside the keynote session with the Somebody Loves Me and... You know, and then you get to DB Blues, the Aladdin stuff that's all towards the end of the set. You start seeing, oh, he played like this week, and then the next week he came in and he's not as inspired or whatever and so on. Then the next week he's back up on form again. Mm-hmm. It's not a one giant decline that we've all heard about and all the nonsense that's been written about Lester Young and what happened to him after the army is... This is a very sensitive man. There were peaks and valleys in his life, in his career, in his emotions.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't just you know, make one big sweeping generalization. You need to look at the music individually and see what the music tells you, and that's
sure.
what that Mosaic set does.
You know, oversimplification.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's another reason why sites like yours are so valuable. You have the space and time and motivation to go into these fine points and not just, you know, repeat the myth, whatever the myth might be.
Right. Well, you know, getting back to Frankie Newton, you know, it's been said for years that he was blacklisted. I'm kind of giving you a little bit of a peek at what's going to be in the next half of the article here, but a lot of people said that. I've heard it said Phil Shapp and Chris Albertson and a whole bunch of other people, and I respect these people, okay? But they said that they believe that Frankie Newton was blacklisted. He got on the wrong side of John Hammond, and because Newton was a communist, he was blacklisted from the studios from 1939 to 1944.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of problems with that myth, a lot. First of all, John Hammond... And Barney Josephson and Frankie Newton were all very close together on the political side. They were all extreme far left. Frankie mm-hmm. maybe one step over in that he joined the party. He joined the mm-hmm. Communist Party. Mm-hmm. Other than that, they were very close-knit. John Hammond was also running, helping Barney Josephson run music at Cafe Society. So if there was a problem between Hammond and Newton, not only would Newton not be recording at Columbia, he wouldn't be playing at Cafe Society, but he stayed at Cafe Society for months after he stopped recording. And Hammond had enough power to be able to keep people from working in New York City. But that didn't happen. When the Cafe Society gig ended because Billie Holiday got a tour, signed up with Joe Glazer. So she took off on tour. The band was kind of left to its own devices. Josephson said, well, you've been here for a year. We'll just put in a new show. And Newton called up his friend Pete Brown and said, hey, I heard about a place called Kelly Stables that's opening, and they want us to be the band. They want us to be the band. You want to come and play? And it was Frankie and Flip Phillips on clarinet, no tenor, and Pete Brown on alto. And so, you know, when you're looking at somebody and like, well, they kept working, and they played on the radio, and they played in clubs, why did they stop recording? Well, he stopped recording probably because of he was a communist. He ran his bands as co-ops. So everybody got the same amount of money, and he probably didn't like the idea of a recording company model where you come in and you make X amount of dollars, a flat fee for recording your creations. Then they go and sell records. They make records and sell them like crazy, and you don't get a dime out of those records. Doesn't matter if they sell 50 or they sell 50,000.
And but he basically, in your estimate, boycotted that system.
He basically said, I don't need to deal with this. I mean, he worked in 39 before he stopped recording in August. He had recorded for all three of the majors, Decca, Columbia, and Victor. He'd recorded for all three of them, plus two of the major independents. Well, there weren't that many at the time, Commodore and Blue Note. And everybody mm-hmm. ran on the same model.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing, this is a bit of supposition here, but somebody had to get the word to Petrillo, James Petrillo, the head of the AFM, the American Federation of Musicians, the union. This is not a fair system. Petrillo's not on the street enough to be able to know this firsthand, but he can have his musicians telling him, hey, this is nonsense. You know, I should be getting money. You know, I walk by a bar and I hear my record playing on a jukebox. I'm not getting a dime for that.
Mm.
I'm not getting anything for that. I think, you know, I mean, they went on strike two, three years later, specifically for royalties. And when it was over, Newton was back in the recording studios again. He never recorded under his own name again, probably because he had raised so much kerfuffle about this. But he did record, and he recorded mm-hmm. quite a bit in 1944 and 45. So, you know, so I think that he may have been one of the people that was making complaints to the union. I think he left recording on a personal choice, not because somebody said, you're not going to record for us anymore. You know,
that chronology makes a lot more sense.
Yeah. Now, this is a guy, George Wein told me, George Wein was a dear friend of Frankie's. He said Frankie had the unique ability to be able to burn bridges while he was still crossing them. Now, yeah, no question. Frankie Newton ticked people off. He said things that he shouldn't have said, and so on. But whether that led to him not recording, I doubt it.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. So this is the kind of material people can get into.
Yeah.
On your site, and you have a bunch. You have a bunch of other writers working with you. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, we did. I do it all now myself because I just don't have the money. To be able to pay for people. But we have had Nikki Schreira, who's now in South Africa. She sings out in Cape Town. She was in New York, and she was writing for us. And she did some concert reviews and one of our sidetracks pages for us for a little while. And she was a marvelous writer. I really miss having her on our site. We had Chris Coulter wrote reviews of some Stan Getz stuff and a book of photographs by Kathy Sloan from the Keystone Corner. And we had We've had Ben Markley, who I just actually reviewed his new album, Marvelous Educator. He was doing reviews for us for a while. We've had a number of people. When the time comes and I've got the capital coming into the site again enough, I want to bring in Hillary Gardner, who is one of the singers in Duchess in New York City. Marvelous writer. And also Mick Carlin, who is writes wonderful books for young adults that feature real jazz musicians. So there's one called Writing on Duke's Train that's about a little boy, a fictional boy, 8 years old, runs away from home, hops onto a train into a Pullman car that he thinks is abandoned, and it turns out to be the one that the Duke Ellington and his band is on. This is 1939. So he gets to meet Jimmy Blanton, and he gets to meet Rex Stewart, and he gets to meet everybody in the band. He gets to meet Duke. And it's a great way for young people to understand who these people are and why we consider them to be heroes.
That's great.
Yeah, and Mick's a great supporter of the site and a good friend. And one of these days, we're gonna have him on staff.
And you pay a lot of attention to books. You've got a lot of book reviews on this site.
Yes.
I'm looking at this one, The Jazz of Physics.
Yeah, that was one of my best of last year. That's a really fascinating book. It doesn't always work, but there's some really interesting comparisons made in that book between the physical world and music. And the guy who wrote it is actually a jazz musician who is also a physical, and he's got a doctorate in physics. And it's really, so there's, you know, I got that last year when I was in New York. I was picking up a copy of the Ted Gioia book, How to Listen to Jazz, which also was another one of the books that I reviewed last year. And the publicist says, I want you to look at this and see what you think. And All right. I took it. And it wasn't until I got home and I started looking through it. And I said, you know, this is really interesting stuff. And I mean, if you watch Cosmos or something like the, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson stuff, you can understand most of it. I mean, there's some places that I'm just like, whoa, where are you going here with this? You know, but most of it is very clear and understand. And he makes good relationships to how it works, how things work in jazz. Fascinating book.
It sounds a little bit like Pythagoras, right? Pythagoras was a
yeah, exactly.
Philosopher.
They talk about Pythagoras' theorem. Absolutely.
I bet. And there's a lot of musicians that have developed theoretical underpinnings. I'm thinking of Steve Coleman, for instance.
Oh yeah.
Who's put a lot of work not only into, you know, becoming a master musician, but also figuring out where that music fits into a larger aesthetic concept, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So book reviews, and now concert reviews. These things that have come through Denver, I assume, are
mostly. Now there is one in there called JHO Goes East, and that's when I was. That was that week in New York, and I heard music. I think 6 out of the 8 nights I was in the East Coast, and wrote about a lot of music that I heard, and so you know the night. Thank God this happened. I mean, with all due respect to my friend who I was supposed to go hear that night in Long Island, and I missed the train to get out there. It was a Saturday night, and I was in New York. I was like, gee, I think I can find some music. 2 calls later, I was at Birdland and heard Jerry Allen, David Murray, and Terry Lynn Carrington. And Jerry, I knew Jerry. I knew Terry Lynn, too, but I knew Jerry because I had sung. I'm a choir singer, as I mentioned, and I had sung the Mary Lou Williams Mass in Denver, and Jerry brought her trio, and it was her trio and Carmen Lundy and our choir and the Creole Parker Robinson Dance Ensemble out here. And it was really amazing. Father Peter O'Brien came out, who was a longtime friend of mine, and I was Mary Lou's manager. And so we had a chance to talk about Mary Lou quite a bit and so forth, and I think we really did a great job on the music. But so I knew Jerry from all those years long. So it was, and I'd reviewed her stuff. She knew who I was, and it was just great to chat with her. And of course now she's gone. So I'm very grateful that I got a chance to hear her one more time. They blew the roof off that place that night.
I believe it. You mentioned an important name that we with Mary Lou Williams. So you sang. She wrote a religious piece, right?
Yeah. Actually, three of them. There were actually three of them. This was. I think this is the one actually called "Music for Peace," but it was. Mm-hmm. We had elements of other pieces, I think, that were thrown into it. But yeah, this was choir music. I mean, she wrote for choir because she was, she was very religious in the last, 25, 30 years of her life. And she wrote these pieces as a message to the world about God. Mm. And so getting the chance to do these things was just so much fun. It was very challenging. The music was, you could tell when we sang the pieces, we looked at the music, you could tell that it had been written by a pianist because all the stuff falls under your fingers. You can play all the tenor parts. There's like four tenor parts. Then you can play them all because it just lays under your fingers as a pianist, right? Mm-hmm. But it's trying to sing that stuff was not so easy. She was a pianist who was writing choral music, not a choral composer writing piano music, not the other way around. See,
how did that performance come to be? Who put it on? And
It was Vicky Berichter, and was an outreach of her group called Canto Spiritus, and Vicky and I had gone to school at the same place at UNC in Greeley, Colorado, University of Northern Colorado. And marvelous music program there, great choir program, great jazz program, still does. And it's a really amazing music school. And I had gone to school, I went to high school in Greeley, so I knew about it and was hanging out at the university several years before I started classes. So I was going to the jazz festival. I went to the Greeley Jazz Festival instead of going to prom. Are you kidding? I'm going to go hear Gus Van Cuso and Carl Fontana. I don't care about hearing rock and roll that I don't like.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There you go.
It's great what's happened in the academic world related to jazz, vis-a-vis jazz, in the last 30 years.
Oh, definitely. How it's kept alive. That's how it's kept alive.
It really has. It's provided employment for so many musicians and a place. Because as we know, jazz is a tough business. It's a demanding art form, but it's a really tough business. And to see so many artists have professorships and long-term relationships with universities, I mean, that's just the greatest thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a lot of friends who are members of the educational side of this, and I'm very grateful that they're there and doing what they do, because that's what's going to keep this music going. Because then you got young people that are already learning about it and know how wonderful this music is.
Yeah. In your travels, have you encountered any of these amazing high school jazz bands? For instance, Lincoln Center has an annual competition, Jazz at Lincoln Center.
Right.
And I'm just astonished. These are high school bands, and mm-hmm. I'm just amazed at how good they are. Some of them are.
Some of these schools have amazing ways of attracting talent. And attracting, the school that I went to in Greeley is now an arts magnet. And I'm really sorry that I didn't get a chance to go when it was an arts magnet school, because that was what I was all about. Mm-hmm. And but it doesn't have to be, you don't have to be an arts magnet in order to be able to get good people. The choir that I sang in Cantor, I started out as six friends who were in a group called the Meister Singers at Cherry Creek High School. And it's the same director that led them and took them to ACDA at Carnegie Hall years before. And then they made the return visit in 2003 when I was with them and sang at Carnegie again. I mean, that's an amazing thing. If you get in with an amazing conductor and you've got talent all over the place and they know how to bring that talent in and be able to sculpt it and make it fit into an ensemble. That is that's the brilliance of music education. Mm-hmm. And, people that want to take music out of our schools, it's like, have never seen this in action. They don't understand. There's more to just getting the kids, putting the music in front of them, and have them play it, and you got jingle bells at your Christmas concert. There's so much more to it, to building up an ensemble and making it work. And that stands whether you're in a school or when you're a professional or a semi or an amateur, you know, adult ensemble. All there's a lot of work that's involved in that, and it's my hat's off to them, man. They do amazing work.
I don't know if conditions have improved, because I know on the one hand there's the pressure to cut, and you know eliminate programs and so on, but I just don't remember there being so many great. I think these are great bands. Some of these high school bands, that show up at Jazz at Lincoln Center every year.
Lincoln Center, and we have them at the Greeley Jazz Festival. They have it's an invitational festival. So you get judged, but you don't get scores. And they really help. The whole thing is the idea is to help make these kids better. We're not going to just beat you. We're not going to browbeat you. You know, we're going to make you better, you know. And I take the same attitude, as a matter of fact, we'll go back to the website here, is that we don't publish primarily negative reviews on this site. I won't do it. I've written those kind of things. It does absolutely nobody, and it does no good to anyone. And
I agree. I
would rather say, look, I get 100 CDs every month. If I pick your CD as one of the six that I'm going to review, you're already pretty good.
Right.
And if, you know, and then I'll say what's good. Now, if I list here something and I say, oh, that doesn't work. That just doesn't work, and I don't agree with that, and I don't like it, and so on and so forth. I'll say so. I'm not a bit afraid of being able to say, no, this does not work.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also not going to start, you know, I'm not going to raise, you know, just go in there and just be negative, 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 and, you know, see, I'm the critic. I have all this power. No. It's not what this is about. This is about the music. This is about supporting the music and making this music continue on past the time we're all here.
Mm-hmm.
This is an amazing art form that we've created. Let's keep it going.
And a big part of that is education and ongoing education for everybody, regardless of whether they're in high school or whether they're in their 90s.
Exactly.
The great thing about this art form is you can always learn something new about it every day.
Absolutely. And people ask me, why don't I go teach? Why don't I do, you know, I want to do more teaching. It's like, I've got the biggest classroom in the world. Are you kidding?
Yeah, exactly.
I got all these people reading about Frankie Newton. Are you kidding? So of course it's there, you know. Yeah. So I wanted to mention something. Since you are working primarily in video, in jazz video, which I adore jazz video. I think it's great. Some of the things that we've done on the site, some of the things I've put up, I'm very proud of because they're interactive and they have video in them. They're embedded. One is the Sound of Jazz. I took the whole show. I put it in Flash video, cut it all up, put all the, you know, each item is, you know, all the introductions are separate and all the songs are separate and so forth. And I put up a historical essay on the Sound of Jazz. You can watch the entire show on my website. And it includes a lot of information, stuff that some of the research went back to my days in college. I wrote a research paper about Bob Herridge, who is the guy who produced that show.
Wow.
And so there's tons of background information about the Billie Holiday, but also about the Monk and about, you know, Basie and all the different things that happened, all the anecdotes and all those things. It's all there. So you can watch the thing and you can read about the show. And I mean, anybody who has never seen The Sound of Jazz, oh my God, you must see it. It's one of those legends that actually lives up to all the hype.
We run a lot of clips from that. So for people that want to see Tom's version, which is, I'm looking at it now, that's why I said wow. Just go to jazzhistoryonline.com. Then go to the tab that says historical essays, and there's a lot of them, and one of them is The Sound of Jazz. It's two pages, and I can't wait to dive into this when we're off the phone, because this looks amazing.
Yeah, and another one we did is in our profile section called The Swingle Singers, Making the Music Dance. The Swingle Singers have been around for over 50 years now. And of course, it's different singers now. It's not the same French group, you know, that did the first recordings in the 60s. But it's, I did a complete history with the cooperation of Ward Swingle. Bless his soul. I'm so glad that he saw this and was still alive to see this. But this has got, again, it's got video all the way through. Not only do you get to hear the French group doing the Bach stuff, there's also the full third movement of the Berlioz Symphonia, which was written for the Swingle Singers, but performed by one of the modern groups with orchestra. And it's fascinating. And there's things of them doing Mozart and things of them doing Astor Piazzolla, and a thing that they did on an underground subway in London, and when they all start singing all of a sudden, people start they all just start, you know, you can see, you know, those people who know the current group, know that group. You can look on and say, oh, there's Toby over there, and there's Claire standing back there, and so on and so on. But they do the Austin Powers music, the Bossa Nova piece by Quincy Jones.
Okay.
And it's really fun. And you just see these people just like, all of a sudden, they got this choir around, you know, singing this tune. So anyway, but there's a lot of things like that are interactive that we put in. We drop in the YouTube clips and we drop in the audio clips and so forth. And we don't always do that with the full cooperation of the artists and so forth. I've been current. One of my current things that I'm doing is one of my dearest friends, Anita Wardell. And she's a British jazz singer, one of the most amazing scat singers I've ever heard in my life. And she is actually coming to the United States this October, and she's going to be performing in Denver. And because of our friendship, we're trying to get something. I think we're 90% sure we're going to have things set up in Chicago for them to sing, for her to sing with another great singer, scat singer, Alyssa Allgood. Well, inevitably, the question, I call somebody up, a booker or somebody, I say, hey, I really want to get you interested in having Anita Wardell out. And they say, who the hell's Anita Wardell? And I say, I send them the link to my website, the profile page, and it's called Meet Anita Wardell. And if you want to know who she is, you can listen to 5 different full recordings of her, plus a video. And it's all there. So it's like the best electronic press kit you could imagine.
Exactly. And even better, it's on the website, so it's embedded with a lot of other great stuff.
Yeah. Learn about all the stuff, yeah.
Well, because I think you raise a really important point. It's not just history and reviewing. It's also helping move the music along by supporting, you know, specific musicians.
Yeah, absolutely.
We do what we can, you know, and if you find somebody that things gel with and things work out with, and you can do projects together.
Exactly. And I'm going to, one of the things I'm planning to write about, I think it's going to be for the next issue, and I'm waiting to hear back from Steve Swallow to see if we can get an interview. But there's 3 groups right now out on the East Coast, and I think we've got the makings of a new movement in this music. The groups are Riverside, which is a group led by Dave Douglas. Hush Point, which is a group led by John McNeil, and Catharsis, which is led by Ryan Keverly. These groups are kind of all in the idea, working in the venue, the idea of a continuum, a historical continuum that starts with the Jerry Mulligan Quartet in 1952, with no piano. That's the consistent thing about all these groups. Number one is that they don't have piano. And a lot of simultaneous improvisation, two horns playing off of each other at the same time. So this is a continuum that starts with Mulligan, goes through the cool jazz stuff, through Jimmy Giuffre and the Modern Jazz Quartet, and ends up with Ornette Coleman's first group. All of this stuff basically was happening in California. In the 50s, and was written off by the New York critics because those guys didn't come out and play in the East. Okay. It was all written off as bloodless, you know, stuff like that. Now it's starting to get some recognition through three groups in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And they all play a lower volume level. It's a much more intimate music. But the interplay is the important thing about it. And the reason why I want to talk to Steve Swallow, who's an old friend of mine and a big fan of the site, is Steve was in the Jimmy Giuffre Trio. Oh. He was there. He was part of this.
Okay.
So I want to talk to him because he's now the bassist in Riverside, in Dave Douglas's group. So I'm really interested in this thing. And I asked Ryan Keverly about it, and he said, well, I haven't listened, you know, I don't know Hush Point that much, you know, but it's like, that's kind of interesting that we're all kind of working on the same ideas. Now, whether anything will come out of it, I don't know, but that's the first thing we've seen really since Fusion, that where a lot of people are working on the same ideas.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
That's the biggest thing about contemporary jazz right now, is that we've got so much diffusion. Everybody's working on their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing mm-hmm. something coalesce, and maybe I can help that a little bit. I don't know. I'm going to try, you know.
Yeah. It's there's so much, so many treasures to mine. You know, and in classical music, everybody accepts that, oh, we're going to take another look at Bach or another look at Mozart or another look at Brahms. And sometimes in jazz, we're focused on, okay, what's the new thing?
Right.
And when we barely digested, you know, the old thing. That was a great experience for me. I started going to New Orleans a lot after the flood in 2005. And I would spend months there at a time. And seeing people play the quote, old music, young mm-hmm. people playing. And you suddenly realize, wow, this is not old music at all.
No. They make it contemporary. One of the things that I... When I taught jazz history, which I did at UNC as an honors project, one of the questions that I asked to my group at the end, it's like, knowing what you know about the music history now, what do you think the next movement should be, and what should the people that make that new music, what music from the past should they be listening to? Now, I can't judge anybody on prophecy, but I can sure learn. From a question like that, how well can you apply what you've learned? How well can you apply to say, hey, that's a really interesting little piece of jazz history there that wasn't really fully explored?
Exactly.
Like the thing that they're doing now with the Mulligan to Coleman. That's an interesting little section. And another one that I kind of would like to look into is all those great Blue Note records that were made in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
There's some incredible music from those songs. The tunes are great. They had something going there in the feel of a Blue Note record. You can almost listen to a Blue Note record and you can tell that it's not something from Prestige and it's not something from
mm-hmm.
Impulse. You know,
mm-hmm.
it had its own thing, its own sound, its own feel.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw a lot of that's from Alfred Lion and Francis Wolfe and Rudy Van Gelder behind the controls. But a lot of it is also the concentration and the intensity of that music. That I'd love to see musicians explore that music in depth because create something out of that. Because that's a movement that didn't go anywhere and it should have, you know.
We cover a lot of that on Jazz on the Tube, especially when we got started. I think that I always thought that was a golden age of music.
Yeah.
So we're talking about jazz history online, and one of the ways you support the site is with contributions from users. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. We have a donate button, and oh boy, we'd sure like people to use it. It's an anonymous donation system, so you don't get, you know, I know who donated the money, and I keep a list, and I will be back in touch with you, you know, if you've donated before and see if you want to donate again. But basically the idea is it's a voluntary thing done through PayPal. So it's safe. You can use your credit card. You can use your PayPal account. and any amount of money. You can do a recurring payment if you want to and have it come out every, pay a little bit every month. But it's very important way of doing it. The ads that you see on the website, which aren't many, but the ads that are there only take care of a small part of what we do here. And this is a full-time job, most definitely, especially when I write the whole thing. But even if I wasn't, it's still, there's a lot that has to be done in order to keep the thing up and putting up the new posts and things like that and writing and so forth and, you know, digging into all this music, you know. So your help is appreciated.
Yeah. And so I want to encourage everybody first to go to Jazz History Online.
Yes.
And once you start digging into it, you won't need to hear any superlatives from me about it. It'll be apparent and obvious. And then if you like it, consider supporting it, because this is not the kind of stuff you're going to see otherwise. You know, it's just, you know, somebody has to have the vision and the passion to take this particular direction. And if you like the water, help dig the well. You know,
that's right. That's right.
That's my recommendation. So, Tom, thanks so much for your time.
Sure.
And great to meet you. And thanks for this great site,
you bet.
JazzHistoryOnline.com.
Thank you.